Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
In 1665, a young man from Martha's Vineyard became the first Native American to graduate from Harvard College. His name was Caleb, and a new novel imagines what his life was like and who are the people that helped shape him. The new book is called Caleb's Crossing. Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist and journalist Geraldine Brooks is the author, and she joins us in studio. Geraldine, there's so little information about this man. Is that why you chose to write his story as fiction?
It had to be, because, as you say, the factual record was so scant. So that's the bad news and the good news for a historical novelist, because it gives you room to use your imagination.
Although you include in the frontispiece and the back piece his actual writing, a letter that he wrote with this beautiful handwriting.
This is true. This is the one piece of writing that has come down to us from Caleb's own hand. And it's in Latin, and it's on parchment, and exquisite calligraphy, flourishing signature. And just the idea of this young Native American man who was born into his own culture, probably around 1646. So he wouldn't have had contact with English people right off the bat. So he grows up in his own language and culture, and then he makes this transition to be among the Puritan colonial elite, writing fluently in Latin, speaking in Greek. It's just a remarkable story to me.
You have a penchant for outsiders, and you pair him with a young girl who, her faith is very strict about who can have certain knowledge, who is able to learn to read and to write, and she herself could get strictly punished. He, on the other hand, is open to all forms of knowledge. He's like a flower blooming into it, and I'm not saying he doesn't sacrifice for it, but it's as though you're comparing these two traditions and the liberty to learn.
These are both people who are marginalized by the really strict beliefs of English Puritan society of that era. So women had a very, very, very constricted place. They were meant to keep the home front. They were encouraged to read. That was okay, because you had to read your Bible. But writing? Well, why would you? That was men's work. Nobody thought women's opinions would be worth setting down. So frustratingly, there are no women's diaries before 1700 in colonial America. And that void there, you know, really astonished me, because we're so used to being able to find some scrap of something or other. But I wanted an outsider's view of Caleb, because even though I do believe that what makes us human beings is the uniting strong emotions that we all share, I didn't really think that I could find my way into his head to really say what it was to be him having these experiences. So I wanted it to be an outsider's eye.
What is the role of Harvard College here? Are they an institution that's trying to restrict culture or dispense a universal culture in this particular moment in history? If you go to Harvard, you can see evidence of Harvard as being the educator of all the different kinds of Americans in the 1700s.
Well, Harvard then is not Harvard now. It's not the well-endowed, cushy institution. They were really scratching for survival. You know, it's interesting to me that the minute the Massachusetts Bay Colony set down their foot, the first thing they thought about doing was building a college. And one of the motivations was that they didn't want the educated English people to die off and not have anybody to lead, particularly in the pulpits of the time. So that was a huge impetus for it. But what Harvard was in those days, if you look at the founding document, it says dedicated to the education of English and Indian youth of this country in knowledge and godliness. And this mission didn't really stick. As we know, Harvard became a place of great exclusion afterwards. But for a while, it was this inclusive place. And there are, I guess, at least two views of what was going on. One was that they really badly needed some money to run the joint, and they could get it from religious English people who were interested in Christianizing the Indians. And so they played that hand. And the other is there was real idealism. There was an idea that the two societies could come together, and that through educating young indigenous ministers who would then go out and lead their people.
It is kind of bittersweet as you read this novel, though. I mean, it is a novel about success and achievement, although sacrifice as well. But knowing what we know about what then came later in history to his people and the other Native Americans in the United States, it makes it a little bit bittersweet. Every triumph that he has, his achievement is colored, shadowed.
We always have to see history backwards because that's how it is. But it's interesting when you put yourself in the head of the people who don't know the future, who have to live history forward. They're running forward into what will become our history, and they don't know. And so it was a very interesting question to me as a novelist of how far to take this story. You know, where do I take it? Do I just stop on the triumphant note of him making it through prejudice, having this incredible intellectual journey, this achievement, and triumphing and becoming one of the most elite and most educated people of his time? Or do I take it further and be true to what happened next?
Well, you have to read the book to find out what happened next. And it's a great book. It's called Caleb's Crossing. Geraldine Brooks, Pulitzer Prize winning novelist and journalist, is the author. Thanks so much.
She has made an absolute literary career out of channeling characters from history.
Yeah, she has this amazing ability to step into their shoes.
Even the medieval characters all the way to the present day. Yeah. More of The Takeaway continues with you, where we talked last week about a different struggle for college students, new graduates facing the prospects of another year of a tough job market.
This is Mike from Oklahoma. I graduated in 2009 with a degree in history, and it took me 2 years to find a part-time job at a museum.
That was a listener who called 877-8-MY-TAKE. Over on our site, there are some tips from our contributor, Beth Kobliner. We have more listeners telling us their stories there as well. Christine from Jersey City, New Jersey says, regarding the discouragement of today's grads in finding employment, I really think they are spoiled. I will be 55 next month and have had unscrupulous and toxic supervisors. The intern who is fed up with staying at the company because she thinks 3 months working for no pay is beneath her should think again. Jobs can be brutal, mean, and horrible situations. But Jessica from Rhode Island disagrees. As a recent graduate with a BFA in graphic design, it took me 4 months to find full-time employment. The competition was extremely tough, and I found that many positions which should be entry-level were instead internships. There's no reason to think that an internship should be unpaid. Your stories and your views, just head to thetakeaway.org. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway.